progress value. I'm not sure if that'll happen. Our goal is at least to finish planting the seeds for Zareya, get that done, and also, if you recall, we did a short kind of mini sugi in between Zareya and Choresh of Hasra B'Shem Ma'av, right? So I hope to get to that today as well. So let's try to. It's too far away. Doesn't pick up enough. Yeah, I guess it's easier to read. Alrighty. Right, exactly. Make sure it's planted enough that it's going to yield the right product. Okay, so where do we leave off? So one issue, we covered the major Rashash Minchas Chinuch issue yesterday and a couple of other points. One other topic that is raised in the context of this whole question of the definition of Zareya has to do with whether or not Zareya requires, definitionally, that the seed be covered in soil. Is that completely necessary, or is it just placing it there, which is enough? Which seems to itself also really draw on the same issues, that is this about the karka, that you're trying to make the karka planted, you're trying to make the karka seeded, or is it that this is about the fact that you are trying to promote future growth, and therefore a seed on top of the ground will also eventually sprout. It doesn't have to necessarily have a covering on it now. And that's somewhat of a machlokas. The Magen Avos was one who asserted that the definition of planting means that it's covered up by the soil. And he has a number of Gemaras which he thinks points in this direction. The Gemara in Makkos and Daf Chaf Aleph, which is talking about a couple of different Averis together, and it talks about Nechafa Dekilah, and it talks about covering it up. And that's one of the proofs. There's also a Tosfos in Shabbos and Daf Nun, a whole story about somebody who puts vegetables back into the ground, and whether the significant detail is that there's still some part that's uncovered, there's still some leaf of the vegetable that is sticking out. So not everyone is so convinced by these proofs. So the Gemara Makkos, because it's also referring to kiloyim, may require specifically that it be covered up, because kiloyim means things are mixed together. So therefore, maybe that requires a little bit of a different standard. And the Tosfos about the vegetables, maybe again, vegetables also, once they're ready, fully grown, and then it's a question of planting them back in again, maybe that's also a different standard. So not everyone is so convinced by these proofs of the Magen Avos, the Eglei Tal among them, and therefore there is some significant disagreement about whether or not there really is such a requirement that in order to violate Zareya, you have to have the land, you have to have the seed covered up. And again, I think it does somewhat correlate to the question of what exactly is Zareya. Is Zareya giving the potential for future growth, or is it making the seed planted, which does somewhat correlate to the whole Rashash Minchas Chinuch story. So what difference does it make whether or not this is part of the definition? Because presumably it's going to be chayav eventually anyway. So there are some differences, as far as I point out. Let's say if the seed gets uprooted before it becomes fully covered, even if you're not of the Rashash view, even if you're the Minchas Chinuch's view, that once it's planted, then you're ready chayav. But if it's not called planted until it's fully covered up, maybe there is room to come and undo it. Or if that doesn't happen until after Shabbos. Or if you have two people doing this together, one person putting down the seeds and one person covering it up in soil, that may also significantly complicate things. So there are a couple of possible nafkaminas, the halacha, of what exactly would be the story if the definition requires specifically covering up with soil. And again, that was the view of the Magen Avos, which a lot of others, such as the Eglei Tal, did not necessarily accept. We also talked a little bit about the question of watering grass, the fact that the Gemara in Moed Katan and Daf Beis and Midbeis brings up a question of the Machlokas in the Gemara, Rabba or Rava, a little bit of a question, what's the right text, but the Machlokas with Rav Yosef and someone else about the question of what is the right Hagdara for Mashkamayim, for watering the ground. It seems to be clear that it's prohibited. It's a question whether it's associated with Zareya or associated with Choresh. The Gemara has this question both in terms of watering and in terms of weeding, in terms of Menachesh. The Rambam, always to keep us guessing, the Rambam splits the Psak and paskins that watering is a tolda of Zareya. the Smag paskins like both, and the Ritva points out that he thinks that it doesn't really make much of a difference because it's really just a Hasra question. No one would say that you're Chayiv too because of this. It's just a question of which one is eligible for Hasra, and apparently according to the Smag it could be either.
Who says that?
Who says which one? The Ritva. Yeah, he says you wouldn't be Chayiv twice. So why is the assumption here that you can't be Chayiv twice? How does this correlate to the sugi we paid more attention to a little bit later, to Ayin Gimel Amid Beis, where the Gemara says that potentially an active Zomer could be Chayiv two Malachas at the same time, and here we're assuming it's one or the other. So there are a number of suggestions, Rishonim deal with this, a number of suggestions as to what's the difference between the two sugyas. One core difference probably is that we're talking purely about Toldos in Morkut and Daf Beis, and there the assumption is that you're not really Chayiv for two Toldos. You're Chayiv for probably one Tolda, and that may have something to do with the evolution of Toldos. That if we assume that Chazal figured out what the Toldos were, so even though they are Asur Menat Torah, but Chazal ascertained what categories are what, so then you have an action, and we know this action is somehow a violation of Shabbos. We don't know exactly how. So Chazal figured out that it's associated with this malacha or that malacha. But once we already have it on the plate, so then we don't have the need to assign it more than one category. It's not like it automatically fit in the category, as would be the case with an Av, and therefore many assume that that might be the difference between the two sugyas, that Mordechai in dealing purely with Toldos, therefore only has to find one label for what we already assume is a prohibition of watering the grass on Shabbos. So once we're talking about watering the grass, so is all water equal? Is all liquid equal? So presumably not. What about Mei Raglayim? What if somebody relieves himself on the ground? So the Sefer Reim holds that that's a problem. That's considered to be productive for the ground. The Shulchan Aruch is working off a different assumption. The Shulchan Aruch seems to be assuming that just practically speaking, it's the question of Metzius, that that's bad for the ground, and that's not something that really has a positive effect. The Tiferes Yisrael took a different view. He relates that his scientists told him that it is good for the ground, and therefore he feels he has to be machmer, especially together with the Uraim, who also had a problem with it.
Hi? Neutral or negative?
Seems like it's negative. He mentions that it's negative. If it's neutral, presumably it would be the same halacha, but negative, all the more so.
Maybe
kotzer, probably not. Could be called kotzer because you have to have a more direct involvement in removing something in order to be kotzer. Although we'll get into kotzer in a little more detail. So that's our next sugya. So we'll for now assume that it's not kotzer, and we'll possibly revisit that a little bit. Hi.
Even if you say it's beneficial.
Mm-hmm. So that's why there are other poskim who are more makel even if it is beneficial. That especially because you throw in the suffix about whether it's beneficial, and this is very much lo kederach and very much if it's beneficial, it's such a minor benefit. Like we'll talk about also, it comes up in the context of spinning. And that there are those, Shvisas HaShabbos, I believe, who is against spitting on the ground, and others, such as Rav Nissim Karelitz and his Chot Shani, so he assumes that it's so low kederach and so not significant that it doesn't add up to a real concern. So putting all the fakes together, there certainly are those who take that attitude towards Mei Raglayim as well, that it's not enough of a composite, positive effect to bother us. I think Jonathan first.
So the Sefer Yirmiyahu was machmir with that, right?
Right. He thought so, this was.
But he knew the idea of Malacha Shneitzer Chlagufa, and he didn't bring that up.
Well, they bring it up at Sirif all the cut, all the everything else. That since it's a question whether or not it's really helpful, and it's Shlo Kedarach, and theoretically it could be done with double intent as well. You know, there are all kinds of variables in the equation. But in the case in which it may theoretically come up, so putting everything together, there are many who think there are grounds to be made. Okay, Gilead.
When it comes to our guy, it's all pretty much equal in spitting. Has anybody discussed the difference between like saliva and like phlegm? Because phlegm is probably less.
It could be somebody discusses it. I haven't seen them yet, but I wouldn't categorically say that no one discusses it. It could be that maybe it is in a different category. I just also mentioned there are those who thought, both in the Rishonim and the Achronim, there's a Ruah has a discussion about this, that the whole discussion of whether it's Zareya or Choresh in terms of Mashkemayim, the Gemara Mod Katan, is perhaps relevant to a Gemara Menachas on Daf San Machdalid, where the Gemara asks, do we focus on Machshava, do we focus on Maisa? The Gemara there talks about somebody who saves a baby from drowning, but his intent in saving the baby was also, or primarily, to go fishing and to gather a fish up from the water. So the fact is he did an act of pikuach nefesh, but his intent was to do an intent of fishing on Shabbos. So to what extent do we focus on one, to what extent do we focus on the other? So over there, the Gemara brings up this two possibilities of Machshava and Maisa. So some of the Rishonim, such as Yorzeru, I think we gave out the Yorzeru at the time, has a number of points in which he gets into here. One of the points he gets into is perhaps there is that going on in the Gemara and Moed Katan, a question of how should we ascertain what we're looking at here. Are we looking at what your intent is, or are we looking at what it's closest to? So, for example, when you're watering the ground, so presumably you're interested in making things grow, but you are dealing with the ground, so it looks a little more like Choresh, while your intent is more Zareya focused. So perhaps the issue in the Gemara, and then the issue subsequently in the Rishonim, is are we focused more on Machshava, or are we focused more on Maisa? Maybe that's what's going on over there. So this gets us into the bigger question of Avos and Toldos in general. And our Malacha of Zareya here was one of the major areas in which this question comes up, because the Gemara has a pattern here which is going to repeat for the next couple of Malachas. The Gemara here on the top of Ayin Gimel and Beis has a statement that all of these different actions, Hazareya, Vahazomer, Vahanoteya, Vahamavrich, Vahamarkiv, Kulon Malach Achasein. So all these actions, whether they are planting seeds in the ground, or pruning plants and trees, or putting saplings in the ground, or taking a existing plant and sticking the top back into the ground and making it grow that way, or grafting things so that they grow, grafting something onto an existing plant, all of these are Zoreya, Kula Malacha Achasein. They're all part of one category, which is Zoreya. But there was a major machlokas HaRishonim as to how does that add up. So does that mean they're all Avos? Does that mean that one is an Av and the rest are Toldos? Does that mean somewhere in between? So this was a major machlokas HaRishonim, and it was a very valuable machlokas HaRishonim because it gives us some insight into how this question is addressed in terms of all of the Malachos. So one position to start with, we had the view of Rashi. So Rashi understands that they are all Avos except for one. What's the one exception? That Zomer. Zomer is a Tolda, everything else is an Av. So there you have a pretty straightforward approach. The way it's mostly understood by the later Svarim, and we discussed this at some length, is that the idea of an Av is that it has to have a comparable function and have a form that is at least somewhat similar for Rashi. So therefore, all of these are considered to be part of the Zoreya family because they all have the function of enhancing plant growth. But only the first four, or however you list Zomer, only everything but Zomer is similar enough in that it's about going in a positive direction, putting something into the ground, attaching something to the ground, while Zomer, even though it has the same purpose, but it involves cutting something out of the ground, so it's so different in terms of its function, or in terms of its form, rather, it's so different in terms of its form, that perhaps that's what Rashi is getting at, that it breaks down in terms of its comparison to the Av, which allows us to have a basic structure, for Rashi at least, that a tolda is something that shares the function without the form. So all the other activities listed here are close enough in both senses. They all share the function, and the four of them are close enough in the form that we can put them all into the Av category. While the Zomer action is different enough in form that we can no longer call it an Av according to him, and therefore we have to call it a Tolda. That was the view of Rashi. While Tosus and the Ritva have it differently, they have only two Avos here, the two Avos being Zoreya and Noteya, which seems to be that they are defining the form even more specifically than apparently putting something into the ground for the first time. That seems to be the av. You could define it differently, but it seems to be that's what they're getting at, that they're also taking a form-based definition, and they're just using a somewhat more specific take on what the form is. So the difference between zarei and ateya on one side and the other malachos on another side has to do with it going into the ground for the first time, as opposed to, say, mavrich or markiv, which involve taking something already growing and putting it back into the ground to grow more, or grafting something onto something that's already in the ground. So those are still positive forms of encouraging plant growth, enough to be a tolda, but not comparable enough to the Zerei action in order to make it into that category, in order to make it into the Av category. Now again, once you say that, just parenthetically, once you say that there's more than one Av in this Av, so then this seems to be, as some of the Rishonim have the expression, a Me'ein Ha'av kind of category that we talked about the other day, the idea of Bishul and Ofeh, for example, which seem to be very different actions, but they share a slot in the 39 malachas. We assume that they are all avos, although we'll mention in a second there might be one exception to that, but we assume that Bishul and Ofer are both avos, but they don't take up two slots, they take up one slot, so we view it essentially as 11a and 11b, and that's probably what Rishonim mean when they invoke a category such as Me'ein Ha'av. They mean that maybe it's different enough to have a different name, but it is essentially similar enough to be considered the same slot. So for example, to go back to Bishul and Ofer for a second, so okay, they're different enough in terms of what we're dealing with that we call one baking, we call one cooking. They have enough of a difference to have different names, but they're similar enough that they both earn a slot, the same slot, on the Avos list. So that's presumably what we're talking about when we say something is Me'ein Ha'av. She mentioned also that the Egle Tal suggests that maybe when it comes to Zomer, that maybe Zomer, really there are different types of Zomer. There's a Zomer that's more negative and a Zomer that's more positive. It's hard to know practically what they mean. It has to do a little bit with intent, that there's one Zomer where you're trying to get rid of a problematic interference, and one Zomer where you, I guess where you're kind of shaping the plant. I would assume that's what he's talking about. And maybe, therefore, one could bring harmony between Rashi, who said there's a Zomer that's just a Tolda, and the Rambam. Because the Rambam's view is that all of these are Avos. It says the whole list makes the Av list. So what is his view? His view seems to be, and this is the way the Nosei Kalim explained it, the Magen Mishnah explains it, that apparently anything that has a strong enough dimyon in function makes it into the list. And anything that's got a weaker dimyon, a dimyon ktsas, as opposed to a dimyon gomer, and clearly these are very subjective terms, but the Rambam's going to say that all of these, since that's what he writes, since all of these are latzmuche peira, they're all there in order to cultivate growth, so therefore that's enough of a dimyon. He doesn't seem to be focused at all on the status of what exactly it looks like. So his view seems to be different just in terms of assessing what considers to be an Av and what's considered to be a Tolda. It's basically just a question of degree, which obviously is going to put a lot of subjectivity into what makes enough degree. If I say form versus function, it's a much neater distinction. But he seems to have it in terms of degree. And then you have the Egle Tal saying that even when it comes to Zomer, where he seems to disagree with the Rambam, maybe it's not an absolute, with Rashi, maybe it's not an absolute disagreement. Maybe it's just a question of different types of Zomer. I think we mentioned then that the Tosas Chaim, Rav Nachum Zemba, so he suggests that this Rambam may also reflect on his view when it comes to Chatzi Shir. We'll talk more about Chatzi Shir. But the question of whether if something is lacking in machsheves, is that an iser deraisa still, chatzi shir, or is that considered to be not really a malacha? So it sounds like from Rashi, as we'll see when we go chazer over chatzi shir, that Rashi applies the concept of chatzi shir asur min haTorah to Shabbos, and the Rambam might not. The Rambam might, we saw, like, for example, when it comes to Rashi, that Rashi might see carrying less than a shear as chatzi shear asur min haTorah, but carrying for two amos, carrying a full item for less than the full dalet amos outside, that would be a chatzi malacha. That would be not really a malacha at all. And the Rambam puts those two together. The Rambam says carrying less than an item, carrying too small of an item, and carrying a big item too short of a distance, they're all the same thing. So Rabbi Nachum Zemba suggests that there's a correlation between this Rambam and that Rambam. That the Rashbam says, we mentioned before, that when you're lacking a shear, it's a lack of melachas machshavas. So the question is, if you're lacking in melachas machshavas, what does that do to you? So according to Rashi, it might mean that, okay, you still have a melacha, it's just missing machshavas. But according to the Rambam, it's knocked out completely. So therefore, it's considered to be comparable to carrying it less than 2 amos. And he says that this major role that the Rambam gives to machshava is reflected here also, because the Rambam says that machshava alone could create an av. And the fact that you have intent to do something similar to an av malacha is enough to make that an av, not even a tolva. So it shows the Rambam's great emphasis on the role of machshava in creating the malacha. So that's why also its absence, meaning in that case not having enough of a shear, is enough to completely degrade the malach. It's an interesting point. So that gives us so far 3 views. Right? So according to Rashi, everything but Zomer. According to Tosfos and the Ritva, just Areya and Noteya. And according to Rambam, everything, it's all enough. Avram?
So according to the Rambam, if you have a Kati shear, you don't have malach to machshavas?
Right. Exactly. That's based on the Rashbam. The Rashbam of Basra says that, and he was putting the two together. The Rashbam of Basra says that a chatzi shir on Shabbos is lacking machshavas.
And so, what does that have to do with machshava?
So he's assuming that machshavas and machshava are the same. Is that a 100% inarguable premise? No, but that's what he's working on.
He's assuming they're not the same.
He's assuming they are the same. The machshavas and machshava are the same idea. Because there's no significance. So we can't call it machshavas if you're taking something which is not important.
Even though you're doing it deliberately.
Correct. Yeah, again, it's an arguable premise, but that's the premise he works on. And just mentioning it now, because he connects it to this Rambam about Av, that a machshava is enough to create an Av, he thought that those were related ideas. So Rabbeinu Chananel is very mechudish here, and it was invoked recently when we talked about a different topic. That Rabbeinu Chananel says that a Zoreya is the Av, and Noteya is a Tolda of Zoreya. And everything else is a Tolda of that. So what idea is he inventing here?
Grandfather
clause, right? Toldas. Grand Toldas. That you can have a tolda, that is a big chiddush. And it's such a big chiddush that we saw when we talked about the Zomer bin Tzarech Le'etzim and about Malach Shinitzrich Legufa, we saw that there are those who don't agree. We saw that when it came to Malach Shinitzrich Legufa, we saw the view that is associated with Iran, that a tolda Shinitzrich Legufa is perhaps nothing, and that there were those who explained it as saying that a Malach Shinitzrich Legufa is itself a tolda. Self shares just a partial relationship with an av. So a tolda, shenetzrich legufa, is a tolda de tolda. And there's no such thing as a tolda de tolda. So that offends Rabbeinu Chananel, because Rabbeinu Chananel does believe there is such a thing as a tolda de tolda, so that seems to be somewhat of a question. So in this case, he tells us it's a tolda de tolda. So what exactly is the basis of this Rabbeinu Chananel, why is he limiting everything to Zareya? So there are those who suggest that he thinks that that's the only thing that was done in the Mishkan, and that a tolda is only the specific act that is done in the Mishkan. It's somewhat questionable whether or not this was true. We saw maybe the Meiri had a different premise about this, but that's basically what's suggested. And that leads to a very big chiddush that Rabbeinu Chananel maybe would say, according to that, and then we saw that he actually does say this in Ayin Dalet Amud Beis, a very surprising idea that maybe Ofe is a tolda, which is very hard to believe. And we just said a few minutes ago that Bishul and Ofe are both Avos, and they share the same slot, and that's certainly the way almost everyone else assumes, especially because it's very hard to take Ofe off the list when it's listed in the Mishnah, as the Mishnah is telling us the Avos and Ofe is there. But if we take the view that the Mishkan is only the things that were done in constructing the Mishkan, so then maybe only Bishul was in the Mishkan, not Ofe. That's what Rashi says. And therefore, if you want to take this idea that an av has to be in the Mishkan itself, so then maybe Ofer turns into a tolda of Bishul, and indeed Rabbeinu Chananel himself does actually say that. A very surprising view, not the way the rest of the world tends to relate to this issue. Hi.
When it comes to melting metal in Bishul,
So that's part of the question. There is some discussion about this. Maybe we'll get to it because it's a little bit of a different topic. But in terms of how closely does Bishul have to follow a food model is part of the question, which some of the Svarim, the Tshuva about this in the Yad Sofer, for example, and some Sofer discussion about this, about to what extent it has to follow one or the other, depending on what the Mishkan's model was. Was it what went into the Mishkan to begin with, or was it things that were done in the Mishkan later? So it's a little bit of a discussion, but it's really a discussion for a different time. Okay, so now just to fill in some of the halachic points that we added towards the end. So a couple of issues. First of all, in terms of the whole famous Lamdish Machlokas, so the Rashash and the Menches Trinuch, but Lamaisa, how do we paskin? So the truth is, it seems like the weight of opinion is really with the Menches Trinuch. Chances are that if you planted something in the ground, you probably already violated the Isser of Zoraya. However, what if the Rashash is right and it is undoable? So for sure you should do tshuva either way. That's highly recommended always. A person should always be doing tshuva. But maybe he could even, to give a real powerful imagery to the tshuva, maybe he can actually physically uproot his avera, give him great inspiration for El. So can he actually uproot his avera? So again, probably not. But since the possibility exists, maybe it's kedai to try. So after Shabbos, seems to be for sure kedai to try. Can you do it on Shabbos itself? So that was a little bit of discussion. There'd be two issues. One issue is it a kotzer issue? As Ephraim just raised, we have an instinct to assume that kotzer is probably the opposite of zareya. So whatever you can't do mishum zareya, you probably can't do the opposite mishum kotzer. So that's not really a slam dunk. Not everyone necessarily thinks that's the case. There are those who thought that it was a kotzer issue. Maybe it's kedai to take that into account, but there are many who don't assume they necessarily correlate 100%. And again, kotzer is our next malacha, so we'll get up to that in more detail. But it's not necessarily the case that just because you may have violated zareya, that to do the opposite is to violate kotzer, especially if you follow the Rashash. If you follow the Rashash that the zareya hasn't really happened yet, then for sure it shouldn't necessarily be called kotzer. But here we're in this funny mix because we're trying to hedge our bets because we're assuming that it probably was zareya. The question is, do we have room to be choshesh to the Rashash at the same time and take it out? So it gets a little trickier, but again, it's still not the case that even if it actually was zareya, it doesn't necessarily have to be kotzer. Is it a muktzeh issue? So then that depends. If it's the kind of seeds that are also edible, so then that may save it from being muktzeh. Otherwise, it would seem to be a muktzeh problem. Again, if you were sure this would save you from a chiyuv skila, so then perhaps it goes back to that whole sugya in the beginning of taking the bread out of the oven, that certainly muktzeh is a far lower level than a malacha, but we don't really have all the elements here to say that we're confident that you're really undoing an actual malacha. So probably the best day to, like the Shvi'isa Shabbos talks about, would be to come back, mostly Shabbos, to come back Sunday and take it out under the possible assumption that maybe that helps. What else in terms of the consequences? It's not just that it's kedai to do it for that purpose, but even b'shogeg, even if one wouldn't be chayav otherwise, the truth is, the Mishnah says in Gittin, that somebody who plants something on Shabbos really should take it out because of the knas, should really take it out because there's a penalty for him benefiting from his malacha on Shabbos. So the question is, why is that penalty so harsh? Because when it comes to, let's say, Bishul, so here we are, at least the third time now, looking at an issue that forces us to contrast Zriya with Bishul, which actually sounds like a nice chena kind of question, the different areas in which you're forced to figure out why Bishul and Zriya are different. But here the question is why the Knas is so much more, because so far we've seen Rashash and Chesrinach, and the question of advancing the process, where we find not everyone is sure that it works by, is a problem by Zriya, but it is a problem by cooking. So here now the question is, why are we more machmir on punishing Zriya than we are by punishing bishul. So if someone cooks on Shabbos, certainly bishogeg, so then he can't benefit from it on Shabbos, but he can benefit from it after Shabbos. So what's the difference? So there are a lot of different theories as to what the difference is, and they affect how it would be applied. If you want to figure out by other malachos, what should the knas be? So it's useful to try to figure out what's driving this difference between bishul and zriya. So among the theories, so the Bir Halacha suggests that when it comes to bishul, it's easy to have a knas that has some difference, because if you normally you cook to eat right away, so now if you have to wait until after the day's over, so then that's already a hecker that there's some difference because of the melacha. But if it's something you plant, so you plant on a long-term basis, so the fact that you're not going to be enjoying the plant on Shabbos is not any type of a hecker, so therefore we have to make a greater statement. Others say that the, for example, the Tosfos Yontif in his commentary to Trumas suggests that the issue is that when it comes to bishul, so bishul you can't really undo because the food was raw beforehand. So you can't just bring it back to raw food. You could destroy the whole food, but that would take you further than you want to go. While when it comes to planting, so you can uproot what you planted and you're back to where you started. But if you're going to destroy your cooked food, so then it means you also have to destroy the raw ingredients, and that's perhaps more of a statement that needs to be made. Others suggest, for example, in the Sefer Orach HaShabbos, so he suggests that here the Maila of Zriya here, and that it's Kedai to take it out, is because you can stop the Avera before it kicks in. Now, does this mean because only if you follow the Rashash? No, not necessarily. It could mean even according to the Mechas Chinuch, you're in trouble for putting it in, but still the benefit will come later when it takes root. So maybe even the Mechas Chinuch would agree from this Knas perspective that there is greater room for Knas here because you still have the ability to stop the Malacha before it takes effect. Again, probably according to both the Mechas Chinuch and the Rashash kind of views. Hi.
Even if it's Moksa?
So no, you wouldn't do it on Shabbos. After Shabbos, you take it out. The Stipler also points out about this that the difference is also similar, that it keeps going, it keeps growing more and more. So there is an ongoing effect of your initial action that it's worth stopping. While the cooked item is already done, there isn't any process that's still continuing from your original action. Sefer Mishnah Rishon, which is also a commentary on the Mishnayos, so he suggests that the difference is that we try to punish you by undoing your intention. So it's just similar to the first perspective, that when you cooked, you intended to have it for today, so you won't have it today, we punish you, we wait till tomorrow. But when it comes to planting, so you plant for the long term, and therefore we have to undo it for the long term. So all of these different suggestions as to what is the reason for this difference in knas, so this could affect how we apply it to other malachas. So we mentioned a fascinating, very unusual discussion that Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein has in one of his svarim, where he talks about a Baal Tshuva, an Israeli Baal Tshuva, who was a contractor. So 6 days a week he would work as a contractor, and on his day off he would build for himself as a hobby. So he built himself a house on his day off, which means he now has a house which he built entirely on Shabbos. Every part of the house he built on his day off on Saturday. So now he became a Baal Tshuva and he realizes his whole house was built on Shabbos. This is a question whether or not he should be permitted to live in the house. So he draws on these various theories to see what it compares to most. And there's different possibilities. He says you can still sell it, which Mishnah Berurah says also you can still sell it. The question of what value you sell it on, the value of the ingredients, you sell it at the value of the finished product. And he ends up suggesting that he sell it and not live there himself. Even though there were grounds to be makel, some of us felt that perhaps there is a tekanas hashavin factor here, that to say that he should have to be constant, especially because he was perhaps categorized as a shogeg to begin with, because the person wasn't religious at the time, didn't know about the whole prohibition, so there we thought maybe we could see a ground to be a little more makel towards him. Rav Zilberstein in the end didn't want to be makel on him, was aware of the same svaris, but this was a fascinating discussion which drew on some of this literature about what exactly is the nature of this knas and why is it applied more harshly towards Zriya than towards Bishul. Okay. Another issue that came up in terms of some of the practicalities of Zriah, so the Shulchan Aruch says, so therefore a person shouldn't throw seeds onto the ground, even if he's not intending to plant, because l'maisa, it will become rooted, it will become plants. The Kalkelos HaShabbos, which is the Tiferes Yisrael's commentary in Shabbos, Kalkelos HaShabbos writes that therefore one should also be careful if he's eating fruit in a garden or taking drinks, so then the liquid could possibly fall onto the ground, or the seeds of the fruit could fall onto the ground. That may put him in the same category. And indeed, the Shulchan Aruch says that one should not wash his hands over the grass because of the psik resha, that he will be doing either some form of zoreya or choresh. We discussed last week or the week before how this is the accepted view of how to do things, even though it contradicts what the Maharal of Prague wrote. The Maharal of Prague said that he didn't think it was a problem because there's no psik resha by Zoreya, so this is against the accepted halacha, because that's what the Shulchan Aruch says, that one should not do this. And the Ramah then goes on to say that he thinks it's really a good idea not to eat at all on the grass, not to eat outside, because of the likelihood that something is going to spill onto the grass, that you're going to have some problem along those lines. And the Mishnah Berurah writes that al-Khil, he thinks it's kedai. It's hard to know how strong of an issur this is, because this is not, he doesn't say it's prohibited, he says it's a good idea not to do this. So then the Mishnah Berurah writes that l'chachila, the tov l'chachila, which means b'dievet, is ra, and it's hard to know what kind of level we're talking about here. We're not talking about skila, we're talking about advice, apparently. But he writes that that's true, says the Mishnah Berurah, l'chachila, even if it's not your field, because the whole question that the Gemara had raised about whether or not there is a psik resha tenichale if it's not your field. So to hear, you might think, okay, if I'm eating on somebody else's grass, maybe that's more tzad l'hakel, so maybe it is. But still, Mishnah Berurah says, chachila, you should be more careful about that as well. Fine? Did you have your hand up?
There's no psik resha by Zoreya.
So everyone else assumes there is. The Maharal was of this unique view. When the Maharal talked about psik resha, he said that psik resha doesn't apply if the effect comes later, if there's any kind of a time lag. And he says that since when it comes to Zoreya, there's going to be a time lag, so therefore he has this chiddush that there's no psik resha by Zoreya.
It's not that we don't control it, because all we can do is go to see the ground where we can.
Right, so that's enough reason to disagree with him, because you are doing your part of it. So that's probably one of the many reasons why, even though his yesod of a delayed psik resha is not so controversial, his example is very controversial. So it's very controversial because it contradicts the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, and all the Sfarim that write about this, you know, have a big footnote, don't try this at home, because it's against the accepted halacha. But also just conceptually, there are a lot of differences one could make that would explain why we accept the yesod probably without that specific example. But that was what the Maharal said, that there is no psik resha by Zoreya. Again, it does not accord with what is done. Okay, what are some other halachic points? Right, so we talked a little bit about spitting on the ground. So it's also a question that comes up. So if you don't want to water the ground, so what if you have sukkahs? You should have sukkahs. It's a mitzvah. Eating in sukkahs, at least, is a mitzvah. We highly recommend it. But what happens if it rains? So if it rains, so then you don't eat the sukkah. But what happens if you covered up your sukkah, so now you have rain all over the cover, and you want to take the cover off? So you're going to... Sorry?
Uh-oh.
Right, so uh-oh is the right reaction. So what should you do about all the water that's going to go onto the ground? So it's a question how much that's a problem. First of all, Post can point out that if you're going to spill it onto the concrete, and the concrete is then going to spill over to the grass, already that helps, already that's more indirect. They also point out, the Chut Shani points out, in the Nissim Karelitz, and others seem to agree with this as well, that it's very likely that if it's after a rain, so the ground is probably saturated. So if you're dealing with saturated grass, so then adding more water to that is not going to help. It's not going to benefit. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank has a tshuva where he also points out similarly that, let's say, there's enough water there that it's not going to help right away. Maybe you'll add and eventually it'll help, but it'll help a few days from now. It's not going to, the ground's not going to get to the water now because it's so saturated with existing water. So Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank says also that's a reason to be makel, together with everything else, that if it's not going to have an immediate benefit, that's not necessarily as much of a problem. Aye.
So just two questions then. So firstly, with the grass already saturated, that wouldn't be the case with the grass directly underneath the sukkah because that was covered in the rain tarp. So that
right, but that's it's less likely to reach there because you take the tarp off the side of the sukkah.
Side.
Right, so it's less likely to be a problem.
And then, so if I have a sukkah on a deck with holes, so that would be equivalent to like pouring it on the concrete and then going through, or is it?
Yeah, presumably anything that bounces off one thing and then goes to the grass, I think that's considered already another level of indirectness.
I mean, we don't really deal with grass so often. Does anybody just talk about what saturated means? A little wet, a lot of wet.
I don't know exactly how you define it, but the chances are, if it's a heavy enough rain that you have accumulated water, so then if you're doing this immediately afterwards, then the rain has probably already hit the water to a significant enough degree that if you're acting quick enough, and it hasn't been 2 days of intense sun in between, you're probably dealing with ground that's not going to benefit anymore, at least not immediately, from this water. That's what it would seem like. Again, it's just a little bit subjective to know exactly what's considered saturated, but that seems to be the case. Another major issue that we spoke about, which is probably a little bit surprising in terms of its leniency somewhat, has to do with sprinklers. So can you leave a sprinkler on over Shabbos? So to water the ground on Shabbos, so we see that's a problem. But you don't have to physically be watering it if you have a sprinkler. So this is an area where I think it's a little surprising to see how makel some of the literature is, because one would assume it certainly seems inappropriate. However, it is explicit in Shulchan Aruch that it is permissible to leave a we'll call it now a sprinkler, we'll see, you have to figure out whether or not that's the right terminology for it, but it's permissible to leave it on before Shabbos and to let it continue. And that's basically agreed upon by all the poskim. The Chazon Ish had one chumrah. The Chazon Ish said that if you have a faucet that has multiple pipes coming out of it, that if you turn it off, then you have to turn it off only at the main place of the faucet, because if you turn it off on one of the side faucets, then it's going to increase the pressure on the other faucets, and then all of a sudden you're going to end up adding to the, by turning it off there, you're going to end up increasing the hydration in the other areas. So that's questionable whether or not that was accepted. Others argued on this, or Rav Tzvi Frank argued on this. But even the Chazon Ish doesn't argue that you're allowed to leave this on. So the Tzitz Eliezer assumes that it's not a concern of what we call Avsha Milsa, that it's going to look like a disgrace to Shabbos because of its impact on people's perceptions. So he has a chiddush there that it's only true by things that are heard, things that make a lot of noise, that's a problem. But things that are visible, we don't necessarily have such an issue with. So that may be the case, but it's still hard to believe that the modern day whoop whoop sprinklers, where the water is going up into the air and making a whole show and everybody could see it all over the place on your front lawn, that that's really appropriate for Shabbos. So the truth is, there are those who do make that distinction. We mentioned that Rav Harfenis in his Tshuvas, he doesn't call it a whoop whoop sprinkler, but he basically says that the modern day sprinklers that are done be'esek gadol and that have this tremendous visibility, he thinks that that is very inappropriate, and that that is a problem. And then he also adds, and this perhaps you could argue on, that in terms of timers, so one would have thought that, okay, so how if we have timers for other things, so perhaps that should be no worse than what we're talking about. So he thinks it is worse. Says, because if you have something that's on before Shabbos, okay, so then everyone can see it was on before Shabbos. But if it suddenly goes on, so then it's going to look like you turned it on, and people aren't going to know that you had it on a timer. So one could question that assumption on a couple of levels. First of all, the widespread usage of timers today, one could perhaps assume that everyone knows such things exist. And also, the nature of the Marasayin is you're assuming people have to be watching specifically now. It's an unusual kind of Marasayin that we assume people would have to take into account past, the present, and the future. Not just see something happening, but see that before it wasn't on, now it is on, and then figure out that it must have been turned on in the middle. Because if it was on the whole time, again, it seems like that is not a problem. So to be more machmer on a timer than leaving it on, is, I think, somewhat of a Chiddush, and there would be probably be those who would disagree. Rav Shlomo Zalman is quoted in some Svarim as also having quite a stringent view of this, also assuming that people won't chap, and thinking it should be Asur all the time. And again, there are those who would understandably disagree with some of those details, that if it's Morat Sanu in the middle of the night, let's say, to have a sprinkler go on when people aren't around to see it, then there are probably significant grounds to be made based on the combination of some of these points. Hi.
Can we also say that it might be totally different because the Shulchan Aruch is probably talking about people who got their livelihood and things like that?
Right, so in terms of Tzorech, right, we did mention that in terms of need, that it is possible that the Shulchan Aruch was dealing with a more pressing kind of situation and therefore didn't feel it was worth discouraging. Since Be'ikar Adin, it's Mutter, and maybe he was dealing with a higher level of Tzorech, then instead of just, he wasn't necessarily talking about beautifying his front lawn, he was talking about not having his crops die. So maybe there is a higher level of Tzorech he was dealing with, it's possible. And we don't have much of an explicit discussion if that's the case, but one could theoretically bring that into the equation and say that maybe if it's not so necessary, maybe we should not look for coolers in this area.
And also, were they talking about like flooding a field instead of a sprinkler, which works a little bit differently, where it's just putting water in specific spots?
And how do you see the difference, that if he's flooding?
Well, because one, you're turning on a faucet and letting it run totally, and it's just totally wild, and it floods the first part, and then it eventually goes to the rest of it, versus a sprinkler where it's set up in a certain way, where you're going to end up not getting so much water all over the place. You're going to only get water in certain spots where you want it.
Were you saying they're flooding the field because it's ultimately negative, because it's going to send?
No, I'm saying it might be positive, but it's just, it's more random. It's not necessarily you doing it.
But how does the randomness play in? Because either way, you're doing it on purpose in order to enhance the vegetation. So the fact that it's going to come more heavily in one place, more spread out, I don't know if any of those factors would make a difference. There's a question over here. Okay. So another major issue that we spoke about, and now again, through the benefit of our cross chazara, we can now benefit from having seen some of the segregation discussion.
Cross-pollination,
yes, I was going out of the way to not make a pun just now. But some of the cross-pollination from the segregation discussion, the modern-day poskim do talk about the issue of what happens if you have a plant in your house and you want to open up the window. And opening up the window will increase the sunlight to the plant and will therefore increase its growth. So there are a number of issues to take into consideration here. One is increasing sunlight a problem? We saw that the Eglital and others had posited that just encouraging faster growth is not necessarily an issue when it comes to plants, which is why it's at least an issue of Min HaTorah. Maybe it's an issue of Rabbanan. Once we're dealing with potted plants in your house, so presumably we're talking about an atzis she'eino nakuv, which itself is a suffix, whether or not there is a daraisa connected to that, which is not the only scenario where this comes up. You could theoretically have a greenhouse out in your field when you might be dealing with an atzis she'eino nakuv, where you might be dealing with things that are actually connected to the ground. So this shiloh could come up in a setting where it is a clear daraisa involved. But let's say we're talking about in your living room, we have a potted plant, so then let's assume we're dealing with an atzis she'eino nakuv, so then that will also perhaps come into the equation. So with all that, so do we have enough to be machmir in terms of opening the window? So there were those who thought there was enough, and there were those who thought that this relates to the Ran and the Rashba. So remember the Ran and the Rashba, we talked about Ipsik Resha in terms of closing the door to your house when there's a deer inside. So we saw there were basically three views, that the Rashba let you close the door to your house and chop the deer on purpose. The Ran didn't let you close the door even without interest in the deer. And the Rashba, and the Shulta Gibarim was in the middle, that he lets you close the door at least without Kavana for the deer specifically. So I think we mentioned the time that Rav Shechter and others maintained that the Shulta Gibarim was a popular view of the halacha, the compromise view. So you find that here also, that you find poskim would take every one of these three views. There are certainly those who are machmir, such as the Shvi'is Shabbos and others, who are machmir not to let you open the window no matter what, regardless of whether you have kavana for the growth of the plant. There are those who would be makel even if you have kavana for the growth of the plant. Possibly also throwing in the fact that it's very indirect, and that there's no visible connection between this light and your plant, which is also something that's invoked by some of the poskim. And you have those who take a shulte givorim kind of view here, and who say that if you want to open the little window so that you could have more light, and it's also going to have the effect that your plants are going to grow better, so then there are grounds to be makel. So you have views all over the map, but the shulte givorim type of compromise is one of the popular approaches that comes up here as well. There is also a discussion, maybe we'll just end our Zoraya discussion on this and then try to get to Hasra B'Shem Ha'av before we run out of time. But when it comes to putting cut flowers into the pot or into a vase full of water, so the Ramah says you're allowed to do that unless they are the kind of flowers that are going to bloom, that are going to open up more when you put them in water. So what kind of an isser is that the Ramah is talking about? Is that an isser d'oraisa or is that an isser d'rabbanan? So it would seem to be that this ties into a couple of other questions. Probably most relevant, the question of whether there is riyah in a atzis she'eino nakuv. And so since this would be an atzis she'eino nakuv, so if you could potentially have zriyah there, so then maybe you're possibly looking at a deraisa. But if you assume that you can't have zriyah in an atzis she'eino nakuv, so then presumably the Ramah is talking about a drabanan kind of consideration. And we mentioned that that question of zriyah she'eino nakuv is also all tied in to what is the Rambam talking about. When the Rambam says you can't put barley seeds, you can't put techitin or sa'orin into water and leave it there, so what was the nature of his issue? Was he worried, like the Merkevitz and Mishnah and the Tiferes Yisrael say, that it's going to sprout, in which case maybe this is comparable to that? Or was he saying the reason you can't do it is because you do it in order to make it more ready to grow in the ground, which doesn't necessarily apply here, so that's all part of that question. Okay, so there's probably even more to say about Zoraya, but in the interest of time, we will close up that topic now. Any questions about that? Any issues? Okay, so then our agenda now, we'll spend the next few minutes talking about this Tosfos about Hasra B'Shem Ha'av, and then we'll try, hopefully, to get all of Choresh in tomorrow, and that'll just leave us with a club on topics for next week, which hopefully we'll be able to do a little more quickly. So in terms of the question of Hasra B'Shem Ha'av, so Tosfos over here in Gimel Amud Beis raises this issue, which Tosfos in a couple places talk about, when the Gemara invokes all the time, why are you chayiv if you do this? What are you chayiv for? Mishum zeh. What are you chayiv for if you do this action, if you do that action? What malacha are you liable for? So what difference does it make? So it's a good question what difference it makes. So the Tosfos discusses, should we assume that it makes a difference only in terms of hasra? So then still, what do we mean? Because are we assuming that when you give somebody hasra, that you have to identify the av? That if you want somebody to be chayiv skila on Shabbos, so it's not enough to say you're being machal Shabbos, but you have to also say you're being machal Shabbos because you are writing? So that's the question. It seems that there are three views in Rishonim on this, that there are those who say it's enough to say you're being machal Shabbos. There may be those, perhaps as a Rashi like this, as Mechas Chinuch goes through it, who says what, but that maybe there's a view of Rashi that you have to have Hasra B'Shem Ha'av. And there's a Rambam who doesn't even require identifying the Isser at all. According to the Rambam, you just have to tell somebody what he's doing is Asser, and that's already enough. So Tosfos here says it can't be that you have to name the Av. It must be that we just are interested in the Av because we don't want you to use the wrong Av. So if you tell somebody he's being Mechal Shabbos, that's enough. But if you say he's being Mechal Shabbos by doing Kosev, when in reality he's cooking, so he's going to think you're making fun of him, and that's not going to be effective. But if you just say being Mechal Shabbos, that's enough. Jonathan asked me once a very good question, that it's easy to come up with a funny example to tell somebody that he's violating kosev when he's cooking, something like that, and they're going to think they're making fun of you. But the Gemara is that asks the question, Mishum Mai, it's usually a more comparable case. It's not as funny a case, especially a Gemara that we'll see soon. We talk about Borer, where the Gemara is talking about actions which are so similar that the Gemara says they should have really only been one malacha. So why is it taken as a given that the person is going to think you're making fun of them. So it's a good question. I don't know if we have such a good answer to that question. But that's what Tosfos assumes, that you don't have to use the Av, but if you use the wrong Av, so then that's a disqualifier. That's going to look like you're making fun of the guy. Hi.
I heard someone say that maybe just because Tosfos is just showing the most extreme example, just to show that all the other ones do it, obviously.
Correct, but it doesn't answer the Gemara's, though. And Tosfos has to explain why the Gemara makes such a big deal about it. So if you want to give an example, you can easily give it a bad example, but you have to explain the Gemara's that give comparable examples, so it's harder. So that's Tosfos's view, and others perhaps disagree. So why would you say that you need Hasra b'shem ha'av? Why should Shabbos be any different? So if somebody, you want to give somebody malchus for eating basa b'chalav, so it's clear that at most you have to say to them that they're violating the Isra of basa b'chalav. You don't have to say you're eating a cheeseburger at Wendy's on a Tuesday. It's enough to just identify the Isra. Why would I have to go into any more specifics if the Torah doesn't go into any more specifics? If the Torah only says don't do malacha on Shabbos, so why should I be obligated to provide more details than are in the Torah itself? So many assume that this is connected to the Tosfos Rid. The Tosfos Rid later on in Shabbos comments that we talked during our introduction about the concept of chiluk malachas, that perhaps based on the Gemara in Yevamos, that Lo Savaru Eish B'chol Moshel Sechem B'yom HaShabbos is coming to tell you that there is a distinction among the different malachos. So every malacha has a separate chiyuv. Fine. But how far do we go with that? So it sounds like from the Tosfos Rid that it's as if the Torah listed every malacha separately. It's as if, instead of just telling us not to do malacha, it's as if the Torah said, don't write on Shabbos, don't cook on Shabbos, don't plant on Shabbos, don't bake on Shabbos. So therefore, if we acknowledge that you have to actually name the Isser at least, so when it comes to Shabbos, we'll treat it as if all the Isserim are listed. That's the effect of Chiluk Malachas. That's how many assume based on this Tosfos Rid. Rabbi Nachum Zemba says like that. Sipesa Frank doesn't like that approach so much, but that's an approach that many have. We wanted to suggest perhaps a different way of looking at it, that perhaps we could wonder what exactly is the purpose of Hasra in general. Why is it that you have to tell somebody before they violate an Aveira, if they want to be Chayav Misa, you have to get them to accept your warning? What's the whole purpose of that? So we noted that when it comes to the Rambam's view, there is a lot of discussion, because the Gemara asks whether or not a Talmud Chacham needs Hasra. And the Gemara seems to be told of the issue on the question of what is Hasra. That if Hasra is just to distinguish between a shogeg and a mezid, so then it sounds like from the Gemara that a Talmud Chacham wouldn't need Hasra, because he knows what's Asr and what's not. And only somebody who might potentially not be aware of the Isser needs Hasra. The Rambam surprises us, because the Rambam paskins that the Talmud Chacham does need Hasra, but he also says this idea that Hasra is there to distinguish between Shogeg and Mezid. So how do you explain that? So what we wanted to suggest was, maybe the question is that the Rambam differs from the other Rishonim in terms of what Hasra is for. That maybe the other Rishonim believe that Hasra is not just there to check off a box, Mezid or Shogeg, but it's also there to ascertain some level of understanding in the Isser. And in general, it's a discussion why it is that Hasra has to be Tochidei Dibur. It's a big discussion. Shos HaChoshen is a very hard time of this in Simen Chav Ches, because Tochidei Dibur is a maximum of 9 seconds. So it sounds like from the Gemara and Rashi and Ksubas, it sounds like that if a person gets Hasra and then Tochidei Dibur passes and he does the Avera, that we can assume he forgot the Hasra. Very hard to believe, right? You say, don't kill somebody. And he does it anyway, and he says, but I just warned you. He says, yeah, well, this is 30 seconds ago. You think I remember? So what does that mean? So some suggest that Hasra is not just there to make sure you are aware of the information. Hasra is there to ascertain that you are a mega mezid, to ascertain that not only do you know that after you did the Aveir and I say, don't you know that's us? Or you're like, oh, maybe, you know, now that you mention it, I remember learning something about that a half a minute ago. But that you are thinking about the Aveira as you are doing it. That's how Rav Soloveitchik explained the idea of Tochidei Dibur. Says we want to figure out Ad Heichan Hu Parik Ol, to what degree is a person involved in not only sinning, but sinning with such a level of rebellion that he's actually thinking about the Hasra right now. So that's the purpose of Hasra. So perhaps you could say that according to the Rambam, he's more interested just knowing, are you shogeg or mazed? Do you know about it? Do you not know about it? So a Talmid Chacham, according to him, you have to figure out how he reads the Gemara, but according to him, the reason a Talmid Chacham needs Hasra is because, yes, he understands what the Aveira is about, but he still might be a shogeg, he still might forget that today is Shabbos, for example. He learned all of Masech Shabbos, but he doesn't remember that today is Shabbos. Or he doesn't remember that this is a Malacha. So you have to remind him. But if you remind him, then okay, he knows that he's amazing. But the other Rishonim would assume that Hasra is about conveying some level of understanding. It's not just enough to know that you are willingly doing an Aveira, but you have to have some level of appreciation what the Aveira is. So when it comes to Shabbos, so we have an issue because the Torah is very vague. That was the whole topic of our first discussion. Torah just says, don't do malacha. And most people don't know what a malacha is. So therefore, you could say to somebody, don't do a malacha. And he's going to say, I'm not doing a malacha. I'm just doing the crossword puzzle. I'm having a great time. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm just dropping some seeds into the ground. I'm not doing anything that's laborious. So therefore, there is a greater need, even though the Torah itself doesn't spell it out, but there's a greater need to convey to the person that, no, there is an Isser called Zoreya, and you're doing Zoreya. When you're doing the crossword puzzle, you're doing Kosef. They have to have a greater understanding of what exactly is going on. So perhaps that's what Hasra, B'Shem Ha'av, is meant to convey. And then we noted that this seems to correlate with the view of Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi, the author of the Shittim Kubetzes, and his Chuvis, that Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi has. There's only one malacha that needs Hasra B'Shem Ha'av. And what's that one malacha? That is Hotzah. So it works out well, because if the idea is that Hotzah is a malacha gerua, so then some of the Rishonim understand that what makes Hotzah a malacha gerua, what makes it a lousy malacha, that people are not able to really understand what exactly is so bad about it, what exactly really changes anything. So therefore, it seems to fit this idea that the lower level of understanding that people have has a greater burden in terms of Hasra, so maybe that's why you and Rishonim, that all the Avos need Hasra, because people aren't able to perceive, especially if you understand that Chazal had a bigger role in determining what's an Av and what's not, depending on what view you take in terms of how Chazal were involved in conveying what the Avos are. So it puts an even greater level of unclarity to the average person reading the Chumash to know what exactly is involved. So maybe there's a greater need to have Hasra B'Shem Ha'av. Okay, any questions about any of that? Okay, so that's basically in terms of Zareya, and in terms of Hasra B'Shem Ha'av, and in terms of the introductory discussions. What we have next is Choresh, and maybe we'll really try to start it tomorrow. We'll just mention what some of the issues are to get a little bit of a head start. So one question is the relationship between Choresh and Zareya. The assumption that Choresh is an independent malacha, is that the case? Or is it only usher to the extent that it prepares for an act of Zriya? And then we'll see, we'll get into it a little bit tomorrow. It correlates, though it doesn't exactly correspond, to a question of what is the definition of Choresh. Is Choresh an act of preparing the ground for planting in a specific way, which might be called Ripui Ara, which might be called softening the ground, because in order to put seeds in the ground, you need softer ground? Or is it Yipui Ara, is it improving the ground? And maybe it's a broader category of whatever is included in advancing and enhancing the ground is considered to be a malacha of Choresh. So we'll see, different Gemaras seem to point us in different directions on this, and various Rishonim perhaps taking different sides in this discussion. So I guess we'll try, in order to keep everything together, get into that more tomorrow. Any questions about anything we've done so far? Any of the Chazar issues? Anything not clear? Anybody want to bring up anything at all? Okay, so then we'll break now. God willing, we will try to get Olo Charesh done tomorrow. Sure.
Any questions now?
Yes.